Congratulations, it's the first day of the rest of your life. Okay, maybe you've made some mistakes. Grabbing that tire iron and smashing Bobby's chest in, well, that might not have been the biggest one, but that's the one that landed you in your current position. On a bus, shackled, headed to Warren, Maine. A few too many beers at that sweet place in Kennebunkport, a few choice words, and now Bobby's got a lifelong breathing problems, and you're headed someplace you've never heard of. Don't worry about real estate prices. The taxpayers are footing your bill. You, my good friend, will be a guest of the state of Maine for the next 5 to 10 years. You finish the drive up there, you go through the intake process, which is about as warm, fuzzy, and humane as you've heard. And now here you are. You've got your prison uniform, you've got your number, and and you even got a place to stay while they figure out your level, how dangerous you are, what level of supervision you require. For now, you get locked into a cell with a couple of other new arrivals. You get settled in for the night, and as the sounds of the prison fade into whatever the hell passes for night around here, you feel them. A pair of eyes from over the near the commode. No one should be over there. You know that corner was empty. No one's hanging around near that nasty thing. But you can feel those eyes burning into you. Watching. Waiting. It's the first night of the rest of your life. You're an inmate at the Maine State Prison, haunted since 1824. Hi, I'm Jay, and this is New England Gothic. Tonight we're going to talk about the Maine State Prison and its reported hauntings. Because what's better on a chilly October night than a haunted prison? The Maine State Prison was first built in Thomaston, Maine, in 1824. Construction started in 1822, but it wasn't finished until 1824. When Maine first separated from Massachusetts in 1820, one of the first orders of business was to construct a prison. Before the two states separated, serious criminals were sent to Massachusetts for trial and, when necessary, execution. But now that Maine was standing on its own 2 feet, just as they liked it, they needed to be able to deal with it with their own undesirable population. It's interesting to me that it was seriously one of the first orders of business. They didn't want to give it time to see if local courts could work things out on their own. They must have seriously felt that there were crime issues that needed to be addressed right the heck away. I haven't found any reliable statistics on crime rates in Maine in 1820. I found some records for murder rates before then, but not anything other than murder. I could probably pull it together if I had, you know, funding and access to records. If I could drive around to all the great towns in Maine, which would not be a bad way to live, and someday if I won the lottery, I'd love to do a PhD program on the history of crime and punishment in New England or in America. But that's kind of, you know, neither here nor there. Mainers felt it necessary to build an official state prison. And this prison, which was officially the state prison, was 74 miles by car from the state capital at Portland. When the capital was moved to Augusta in 1827, the prison was closer at only 50 miles by car. And again, you know, this is the early 1800s. They didn't have cars, so, you know, you can kind of figure out for yourself how long it would have taken to get from place to place by foot or by wagon. Augusta is inland. Travel by land was much riskier than travel by boat. part of the reason that authorities cited the prison at Thomaston in the first place was that Thomaston was by the water. Prisoners and supplies were often brought by boat to the wharf associated with the prison. By the 1950s, you kind of could tell where the wharf had been. But obviously highwaymen were no longer an issue in the 1950s, so, you know, people came by bus, or by car. The original design consisted primarily of a rock quarry and holes in the ground. These holes were the cells. At the bottom of the hole was a hammock, a rough stump on which to sit, and a Bible. Guards would lower food to the inmates, rough, coarse food, it's specified in the plan for the prison, and water. And they would lower an inmate to allow, they would lower a ladder to allow the inmate, I'm getting ahead of myself here, to rise to the surface to work breaking rocks, and then let him or her, because women were incarcerated right alongside the men, back to their cell. People were generally incarcerated alone. So you're alone in this hole in the ground. When you are in the hole, there is like a grid over the top so that you can't find a way to climb out. In the worst of inclement weather, you might be provided with a tarp over the top of your hole. Then you're in the dark, in a damp hole. All confinement is solitary, and inmates are not permitted to speak while you are working in the quarry. I'm laughing because it boggles my mind, but it's not really something to laugh at. We now know that solitary confinement is kind of, not kind of, it is torture. And it wasn't really intended to be not torture at the time. Anyway, we'll get to that. It was eventually determined by the state that making inmates sleep in holes in the ground wasn't exactly conducive to anything, never mind rehabilitation. And they were allowed to build an actual prison building. but solitary confinement and silence were still the rule. This is called the Pennsylvania Plan. Eastern State Penitentiary gets the credit for developing this, but Eastern State wasn't built for several years after the construction of Maine State Prison. So it should really be the Maine Plan. Prison industries eventually spread beyond quarrying and breaking rocks. A person can still purchase inmate-made items at a gift shop in Thomaston, should you so choose. I'm not 100% sure on the distribution of funds from the purchase of these items. I don't believe that all of these funds go directly to the inmate's canteen. This may or may not be an issue for you, depending on your views about crime, punishment, and rehabilitation. I am not judging. There is some gorgeous and unique stuff in there. Interestingly enough, in 1849, a fire burned a part of the prison and no one escaped. They didn't even try to escape. In fact, inmates voluntarily worked to put the fire out. There were other fires and other changes. In 1935, women inmates were moved to their own prison in Skowhegan, instead of resorting to some really bizarre attempts to screen men and women from each other's sight. There were, like,
reverse awnings on windows in the prison industries area so that women couldn't see the men while they worked in the quarry. It's weird. But you know what? I wasn't there. I don't even work in a prison. I can't really say, you know. A gentleman by the name of Joseph Jackson wrote an amazing article in The Guardian about his time in the Maine State Prison, starting in 1995, and how he works as a prisoner advocate. He runs a nonprofit. When I read that the prison was moved from Thomaston to Warren, and that the inmates really objected to and resisted the move, I was curious, because the Thomaston facility was really old and definitely not up to the task of holding as many men as it contained. Logistically and practically, it must have been just a grotesque place. But according to Mr. Jackson, when he entered Thomaston, Maine had some very progressive correctional policies. There were no prisoner-on-prisoner deaths at Thomaston between 1995 and 2002. Now, I remember those years, although I was in Massachusetts at the time, and we were constantly inundated with images and TV shows about how violent prison was and how it basically turned people into, you know, rats or whatever. And they would just kill each other every day for no reason. So Mr. Jackson's comment was definitely a surprise, especially since I'm supposed to be looking into a haunted prison. Here's the thing, though. The haunted prison isn't at Thomaston. Yeah, about that haunting. In 2002, the state of Maine decommissioned the prison at Thomaston and built a new one in Warren. Warren isn't far away from Thomaston. It's just a little bit further inland, which is fine. I mean, you don't need to bring anybody in by boat anymore, I guess. You know, highwaymen are no longer a consideration. The old prison had gotten a little bit funky. You know, it certainly wasn't built for the number of men that it held. There is definitely documentation that the prison was dangerously overcrowded. It's not just, you know, I'm not casting stones at Maine here. I love Maine. Tough on crime policies require, and these were all over the country, required long sentences, required custodial sentences for nonviolent crimes, and required custodial sentences for people who were repeat offenders. The issue is that Maine didn't have any place to put them, so they had to put them in jails, the prisons that they had. Yeah, and again, this is something that happened all over the country, and it continues to happen all over the country, because, you know, if the law says you've got to put them in prison, you got to put them in prison. And so they built this new prison, and they moved equipment and some building materials from Thomaston over to the new location. They moved the inmates without warning and by dark of night. They didn't move the personal touches or the single and double cell system, or any of the procedures that gave inmates a voice. That is according to several sources, to include Mr. Jackson. So you go from having one person to a cell, or at most two people to a cell, to having, you know, a whole bunch of people in a cell without really having as much attention to temperament and mental health issues, and you can see where this is going to go south. According to both correctional officers and inmates, people feel that there are eyes on them all the time, even when they're alone. This may seem like a reasonable feeling, considering surveillance systems and the fishbowl feeling that prisons are kind of designed to have. I mean, they're not exactly private places. But one might expect folks who have been in prison for a while, or several times, or seasoned correctional officers to be able to differentiate between, you know, hey, I'm in prison and I have no privacy, and hey, someone's watching me. People have reported seeing prisoners who are no longer among the living as well. Actual full-bodied apparitions. Again, reports are coming from both inmates and correctional officers who are likely being tested for substances. So, I guess we have to ask ourselves, what is it about this place that makes it so haunted? Surface of things, it doesn't really seem like rocket science to figure out what makes a prison haunted. It's a prison. It's a place where people who have allegedly made some really subpar choices in life go to learn to not do those things anymore. It's not gonna be a bed of roses, right? And I think we need to start there with our answers. We don't even really need to get into the history of this place or into academia. We hear stories like this about old psychiatric facilities, too. And at least those places started out with good intentions. Prisons really don't. Every once in a while, you hear about a reformer coming along and talking about rehabilitation. But even those guys admit that the other side of the rehabilitation coin is punishment. As a society, we have decided that people in prison deserve to be punished. As a result, they're cast aside, and very few people actually care what happens to them. When Darren Rainey, a mentally ill man in Florida jailed on a drugs offense, was tortured to death in a hot shower, allegedly by correctional officials, outrage was muted. He was, after all, incarcerated. An inmate who was beaten to death while still in handcuffs, also in Florida, didn't even raise a murmur. The initial design of the Maine State Prison was to put offenders into such deplorable conditions that only the memory of their sins would be their companion. Like, they were supposed to be feeling nothing but despair and grief. There was supposed to be no comfort at all, nothing to distract them from their misery. And, what gives rise to ghosts? Should you believe in them? So you've got a population that almost no one cares about, which makes them ripe for abuse. And many of the incarcerated up until the second half of the 19th century were also suffering from severe mental illness. So you've got a bunch of people who can't get away, and that includes the guards, who are stuck with someone who may be experiencing extreme psychosis or hallucinating or whatever. It's going to be a pretty miserable experience for everyone, even without adding other stressors on top of that. And well, let's face it, some people are in there for wrongful convictions. Some people are in there because of circumstances, you know, most crime comes from poverty, and I'm just not going to judge. But there are also some people who are in there because they absolutely need to be kept the heck away from society. They're not any less dangerous to other prisoners just because they're behind bars. We hear about hauntings at prisons and jails all over the country, from California to Maine. Eastern State Penitentiary is one that's been covered by ghost hunting shows all over the world, and why not? Like I've already mentioned, they get credit for developing solitary confinement, called the Pennsylvania system, when Maine developed it first. The old Missouri State Prison is another pretty notorious haunted prison. They do actual tours. You can sign up for them, but not if you're under 13. You can also sign up to do actual ghost hunts there. You can go to their website. It's very professional. So haunted prisons are definitely, you know, a pretty common thing. The other issue in prisons that can lead to the whole haunting thing is that sometimes inmates don't make it out alive. You know, sometimes you get someone who's got a really long or life sentence, and, you know, overcrowding is also a perennial issue in correctional facilities. It's like any other kind of housing. If you build it, you will fill it. And then you will overfill it, except what you overfill it with isn't yarn, it's human life. I'm not going to get into the reasons for that here, because A, I've already kind of gotten into them, and B, going into them further would involve giving a political stump speech, and I am way too sober for that. There's no one U.S. political party that has a monopoly on tough-on-crime legislation in history. The problem is, when you get into overcrowding, you also get into issues of epidemic disease, which is one of my favorite topics, actually. I know, that's so wrong and grim. This year, the big question has been COVID. Do incarcerated people deserve masks and testing? Yes. Should we release certain groups of inmates to reduce the spread of COVID? Also, yes. I'm not just saying this because inmates are people. I'm saying this because we've got a whole lot of history telling us exactly what happens during epidemics in prison. Spoiler alert, it doesn't just affect the people who are incarcerated. The Maine State Prison experienced documented cases of both dysentery and typhus in 1849. I don't have written down mortality statistics, but it was sufficient for them to have written down that these diseases carried away many inmates. So if you're looking for who those full-bodied apparitions might have been, there's a good bet that they might have been people who suffered from dysentery and typhus in 1849. These are both diseases of overcrowding. You can look into, you know, slums in the early industrial age, and you'll see both of these diseases. You can look into people who are displaced by war and wind up in refugee camps. You will see both of these diseases. We don't have names or specifics about individual ghosts. Oddly enough, it's hard to send a paranormal investigation team into an actual prison that is currently operating. Funnily enough, they think that it's a security risk. Go figure. And you can't send them into Thomaston because they razed Thomaston to the ground. There is no way that the Maine State Prison could have avoided outbreaks like cholera, which is also a disease of overcrowding and poor sanitation, and really kind of did its thing all through the Eastern Seaboard, kind of during the 19th century, or the 1918-1919 flu epidemic that killed millions of people all over the world. Tuberculosis continues to be a serious issue in prison populations. It always has been. It probably always will be. And because the populations can be kind of transient and service, you know, medication service can be disrupted, drug-resistant varieties can also be found in prisons. And you may be thinking, you know, since what we're talking about is who these ghosts might be, it's the state prison, and the death penalty was very much a thing up until the 1970s, right? There must have been some grisly executions in the Maine State Prison to give us names to go with these hauntings. Well, you'd be kind of right and kind of, you know, less right. Maine had a death penalty statute on its books from 1820, and a good long list of offenses that qualified for it, too. Here's the thing. Maine became a state in 1820. Before 1820, prisoners, like I said before, would be sent to Massachusetts and executed in Massachusetts if they did something that required being executed, such as treason or murder or rape or burglary. Maine became a state in 1820, and they could have executed people for a whole bunch of crimes after that. At any point. Instead, they spent a bunch of time debating the death penalty, reduced the number of crimes for which the death penalty was considered appropriate, and made a law that stated that the governor had to personally sign the death warrant at least 1 year after the sentence was passed, giving tempers time to cool, and personally send it directly to the hangman. Governors really objected to that one. They didn't want that kind of personal involvement. They felt that it violated the separation of powers. So even though Maine became a state in 1820, Maine's first execution took place in 1864. That's right. It took Maine 44 years to go from "we're a state now," with a prison and executions, to "here is someone whose crimes actually warrant the minimal 1 year waiting period, having the governor personally sign the death warrant, and sending it personally to the hangman directly." Who was that first person? Francis Spencer. Executed on June 24th, 1864. What was his crime? Well, he was already incarcerated at Thomaston for another crime, which seems to have been forgotten by history. But since he was there anyway, he figured that he'd murder the warden. Yeah, that's not going to end well. And hey, maybe the warden is one of the ghosts. But the execution went about as well as could be expected. Indeed, it was a well-attended spectator event. Despite cries of fire that turned out to be an overly smoky nearby chimney. Somehow Spencer thought that there might be clemency from the governor. There was not, considering that the governor had to personally say, "yeah, do the thing." So, the smutty-nosed axe murderer was hanged here, but that's a story for another day. So is the Thorndike Slayer. But I'm going to have to do a whole bunch more research before I can even promise a story about him. But I like the name. I mean, that could be a great band name. The execution of Clifton Harris in 1869 did not proceed so smoothly. While in most areas the death penalty is disproportionately meted out to people of color, and particularly to black men, Maine has only executed 3 black men since coming into existence as a state. Clifton Harris was convicted of murder, robbery, and rape, despite accusing 2 white men of the crime. He is said to have been developmentally disabled and was physically a small, slight man. This lends credence to the theory that his confession was intimidated or coerced out of him, especially since evidence at the scene heavily implicated one of the men he accused. The white men were acquitted. Mr. Harris was convicted, and his botched execution caused him to die by slow strangulation rather than the quick snap of the neck intended in a hanging of the period. It's possible that he may be one of the restless dead who made the move from Thomaston to Warren. This soured Mainers on the death penalty, but they didn't manage to abolish it until 1876. They revived it again in 1883, just in time for Daniel Wilkerson to murder a policeman. While the evidence in his case seems to have been overwhelming, his execution was also botched, and this gave Mainers the impetus to once again ban the death penalty in 1887. He, too, could be one of the deceased troubling today's incarcerated men. For what it's worth, Maine has made several attempts to revive capital punishment, but all of them have met with failure. I tried to find facts about the 2 towns in question that would maybe help make the hauntings a little bit more powerful, but there wasn't really a whole lot. Every town has its secrets, every town has its, issues, but there wasn't really much to find that would suggest why the hauntings were powerful enough to follow the prison to a whole different town. Warren, the current site of the Maine State Prison, was the site of some conflict during the French and Indian Wars. It lies on the St. George River, so that could be powering up whatever residual effects there might be. Thomaston has ties to Quebec and was previously a stockaded fort known as Fort St. George. The town didn't get a whole lot of settlers until the end of the American Revolution. There's just not a whole lot to kind of suggest more than what you've already heard. Although if anybody lives in the area and wants to shed some light, please let me know. As usual, we've got 3 missing people from the New England area for your consideration tonight. All of these people have friends and family who love them and who need to know what has happened to them. If you have any information, please contact the agency associated with their name. Thomas Doolin is a 59-year-old white man from New London, Connecticut, that is. He's 5'10" and 190 pounds. His family last heard from him by text on December 6th, 2019. He has brown hair and blue eyes. If you have any information, please contact New London Police at 860-447-5269. Baruch Roberts, then 78, disappeared from Friendship, Maine on July 21st, 2019, with the intention to go kayaking for a couple of days. He would be 80 now. He has gray, thinning hair, a white beard, and blue eyes. He also has scars on his legs from a chainsaw accident. If you have any information, please contact Maine Marine Patrol at 207-633-9595. And Michael James Sinnott was last seen on June 13th, 2019, in South Kingstown, Rhode Island. He is a white male, 22 at the time he disappeared, 23 now. He is 5'11" and 150 pounds. He has short brown hair and brown eyes. His car was found unattended in the area of the Great Swamp Wildlife Management Area. If you have any information, please contact North Kingstown Police at 401-294-3311. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Join us next week when we look into a Boston disaster that seems to have been lost to time.